studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Barry Livingston, an actor with a career spanning the last half century. You know him from his role as Ernie on My Three Sons, but he has acted in many television shows, movies, and stage productions. He's also written a great book. It's called The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. Barry Livingston, welcome to our show for Hunt's Ketchup. Welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, or Chevrolet, or all of the other sponsors we had. I appreciate the intro, Gary. Thank you.
Well, I really did enjoy your book, and I think people will love it if they're interested in acting and how an actor prepares. It was a very serious and interesting work. And I want to ask you about some of your early days and your early mentors when you got into show business. I was your debut. You were fired from your first film by the great Leo McCarey.
The great Leo. Yeah, he was. I guess his one of his great movies was Duck Soup. I think he won an Oscar actually for something else.
The Awful Truth with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne.
Yeah, but he was a screamer. He was an old school Hollywood director. You don't find those guys much anymore. I mean, I still do quite a bit of work in Hollywood and TV and film, and those kind of guys don't exist. That's probably the unions and people. Crews would just walk off the set. But he came from an old dictatorial school of directing, and he took a. He didn't not like me personally. He was trying to get me to stare at a TV set and ignore Paul Newman, who played my dad in the movie Rally Round the Flag Boys. And and that was his direction. When Paul comes in, he's playing my dad into the living room. He said, "Just stare at the TV. That's all. I want you to just look at it." Well, we get 30 seconds into the take, and he'd go, "You're not looking at the TV. You know, I'm telling you, kid, look at the TV. That's all you got to do. It's simple as that." We did this four or five more times, and he was getting angrier and angrier. Paul Newman eventually, being the cool guy that he was, said, "Hey, it's a little guy. This is my first job. It's 5 years old." And he said, he's probably just distracted or tired. And he said, "Somebody give me a puppet. Shoot it from another angle. I'll get in the TV cabinet." It was an empty box. I'll wave at him with the puppet. We'll, get his attention. They tried that, and even that wouldn't work, which McCarey's head practically blew off the top of his shoulders. And so he said, "Something's wrong with this kid. We better take him to a hospital." And they looked at me at the hospital, said, "It's not a seizure, nothing serious. He just needs glasses." So I came back to the set a couple days later, and the producer took one look at me and they said, "This guy looks like Jerry Lewis from The Nutty Professor now. This is not what Paul Newman's son we envisioned when we hired this boy." So, I wound up with glasses, but I also wound up being fired. And that was my introduction into the wonderful world of Hollywood. It's pretty brutal.
But, of course, the glasses turned out to be a great thing for you.
Well, that's how it works sometimes, isn't it? Sometimes what seems like a huge, huge disaster can turn around because, yes, in fact, it did create an image that, I don't want to take, claim for certainly this title, but maybe I should. I was a prototype nerd.
You invented the nerd.
One of the first kids that certainly as a kid, I think Jerry Lewis and all those, whatever, there were kids that were guys that were kind of goofy, weird-looking, but I was accepted on television, particularly TV, which was very image-conscious, and even film. If you look back at that era, most kids looked like my brother Stan, who had, blonde hair and blue eyes and all these little perfect Aryan little children, and I was a real ragamuffin mutt, and with glasses and buck teeth and a bowl haircut, and so... Yeah, it became kind of, that did, decades later, that became, it's like Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber. I think he stole my look. and it really was a nerd, a prototype nerd.
Well, you mentioned Jerry Lewis, and I fondly remember you ordering jelly beans in the Errand Boy, and Lewis going up and down the ladder and getting this giant jelly bean thing. Wouldn't you rather have a bonbon? What I want to know is, when you see that, can you actually remember doing that, or you just know because it's in the thing? I mean, you were a really little kid.
I do remember it, and what I remember being on the set, and I have a, thank God, I still have a very good memory, once you get up in age, like, like I'm getting. But I recall it very vividly. I recall being screamed at by Leo McGarry. I recall being on the set with Jerry Lewis, and primarily because I was a kid and he was a god, you know, to all the children in that era. To be working with Jerry Lewis was, you know, like Santa Claus. He was the funniest man on the planet, you know, in the early 60s. So, you know, I was primed to have a great experience there. And then I recall him being very manic, running around, you know, not just the stuff that we were shooting, because he was directing, and I think he probably wrote that movie too. But, you know, and I recall him running in front of a camera that was moving, and the camera collided with him and knocked him down, and he had got a gash on the top of his head or something where the camera slammed into him. And, you know, it was, you know, you get little flashes of memories. I don't remember every second on the set, but I recall that quite vividly, that he was, you know, very manic. And, you know, I think people in later years, or he kind of confessed the fact that he used to love them to, like, eat amphetamine. So maybe he was really hyped up.
It
or
might have been, yeah.
Off that day.
We're talking with Barry Livingston, the great actor and child actor and adult actor as well. Before you became Ernie, you were a regular on the, semi-regular, I guess, on the Ozzie and Harriet, The Adventures. I always thought it was funny that it was called The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, because they never got into very serious adventures, except,
never,
you know,
ventured beyond the house, you know, let alone maybe a block to the malt shop, but that was it.
The adventures were usually about the pancakes or something, but I wasn't very surprised, but some readers might be surprised to hear you say that you think that Ozzie Nelson was brilliant and one of the first auteurs in television.
You know, it was deceptive. His talents that were exposed to the public, they, you know, they knew him as bumbling, fumbling Ozzie, the dad who was sort of couldn't, you know, put two words together in a sentence, that he was always stumbling over things and forgetting, you know, having Harriet put him in his place and the kids, and much of the contrary to that image. He wrote and directed, starred in all those shows. He also made a star out of Ricky, because he recognized the power of the medium, and Ricky was in his own right was a terrific rock and roll, you know, singer, had many, many hits. But Ozzie knew the power that you could put Rick's new song that was coming up, he'd write a song, a sock hop, and Rick would do that song on the show, and, you know, 30 million, 40 million people were seeing, watching TV in those days, you know, each show, and boy, what better way to promote your product? So he was, you know, a very shrewd man. He was not the fumbler bumbler in real life that people might have thought.
Elvis Presley confessed years later that he would always watch The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet so that he could see Rick Nelson perform. And, of course, James Burton, who played guitar, later played with Elvis.
Played with Ricky, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, with Elvis. And then, you read the book, obviously. I had an encounter with Elvis. It was around that era. I was prior to being on My Three Sons, and I was working in a lot of films and episodics. I was a recurring character on the Nelson show at that time. But I was doing a lot of films, and one of them, I was working with Debbie Reynolds at Paramount doing My Six Loves. But I had a lot of spare time. You know, you're on the movie studio and you're sometimes not working, so I loved walking around studios. They just to this day I do that when I go on an interview. You know, I love to walk around. I don't know, you never know who you're going to bump into, what you're going to see. Well, anyway, in this day, and it was probably about, you know, 10-9 years old, it was the very early 60s, and I came across a limousine that was idling outside of a soundstage, long, beautiful white Cadillac. The back door was open, you know, just inviting me to look inside. And I did, and you know, it was this customized white leather interior and white furry, you know, floor and gold toggle switches, and it also had a TV in the back, which that blew me away, because, you know, in the early 60s, that seemed like something out of Buck Rogers. It was just so Jetson space age, a portable TV. And then I heard this voice behind me, and it turned around, and it was Elvis, and it was his car. They had just customized it. We're bringing it over to him. He was shooting another movie, which I think was Fun in Acapulco. And we hopped in, and, you know, he said he was just going to take a little test spin around the lot and asked me if I wanted to join him, which, you know, my mother in the, you know, her voice in the back of my head saying, said, you know, never ride with strangers, never ride with a stranger. And I justified it very quickly by going, Elvis is no stranger. Everybody knows Elvis. Everybody loves Elvis.
They don't come much stranger than Elvis, actually.
Yeah, and maybe stranger. But he was the biggest star in the world, and I went, sure, this is okay. And I hopped in with him, and we just took a little tour around the lot. He flicked on the TV, which is what I was hoping he would do, to see how it worked. And we watched an episode of Popeye the Sailor, and apparently he was a big fan of cartoons, which was all right with me because I was about 9 years old. And we, 10-minute ride with the king. It was a little chit-chat here and there, and we were back to our sound stages. It was
fantastic.
Quite an amazing moment. Yeah.
I bet. Well, one of the actors that you worked with briefly, and you mentioned in your book, but you don't tell me everything that I want to know. I'm a big fan of David Janssen. I think he's one of the greats. Television actors of all time. And you encountered him, you had some time with him. What was he like?
Yeah, well, that was during that film. That film had a tremendous amount of talent in it, My Six Loves. Debbie Reynolds was probably the biggest star in Hollywood at that point. And the other lead actor was Cliff Robertson, who was in it, David Janssen, Eileen Heckert, who was a great actress of that era. And anyway, David was funny because he had that kind of tough guy image, and he was playing Debbie Reynolds Broadway. She was a Broadway star, and he was her manager, so he was a real kind of tough New Yorker, wise guy, smoking a cigar. And he took a liking to me, too. It was funny. He we did a couple scenes. If you see the movie, you know, I'm sitting near him, and he's always offering me a cigar. You know, I mean, he was just kind of trying to do a little bit with me, you know, because I was playing this runaway kid, you know, an orphan. And Debbie Reynolds took us and my other brothers into her home in the country. And Janssen, you know, doesn't like the whole idea. And he's trying to, you know, probably make me sick from smoking a cigar or something. But he had little bits that they started to throw in because Janssen seemed to take a liking to me. And he's a pretty cool guy.
Barry Livingston, of course, you were a regular on My Three Sons, and if I remember correctly, you were not a son when the show was on ABC, and then when the show went to CBS, you magically became one of the sons.
Yeah, I was brought on originally as a friend next door, and I think in the first year I probably did about, 15 to 18 episodes as the friend. My brother Stan played Chip on the show, Stan Livingston. I was his buddy, and then the next season, I didn't know it, Tim Considine was decided to leave the show. He was playing Mike, the oldest son, and the producers informed me that I was a foster child, and that the storyline would be is that the Douglases were going to adopt me and bring me in, to their household because my foster parents were going to be leaving the country or something like that. So I was thinking it would probably change my whole characterization had I known earlier that I was a foster child, but as it turned out, I was like, great. I was like the pitcher in the bullpen, the starter was leaving the game and they looked around to see who they could bring in as a replacement. And
you were the relief son.
And I came in as the relief pitcher, the adopted son Ernie. And, went another 7 or 8 years.
It's amazing you were talking in your book about the bizarre method by which My Three Sons was filmed, in which all of the scenes with Fred McMurray, no matter how far into the season they went, were all filmed at once, and then you guys would finish the show without Fred McMurray around so that he would have more time off.
It's because he was such a big star. Fred McMurray was one of the first movie stars that came into that decided to do television at that point. It was kind of a no-no. It was kind of a step down in your career that you were a movie star. You were sort of royalty in Hollywood. Television was kind of a grindhouse for people. And so to get a star of his magnitude to agree to work the hours and the commitment of time, they said, here's what we'll do. We'll just shoot all of your stuff at once. We'll work out 10 scripts a day if we need to. We're going to shoot just the master shot that has everybody in it, and then we'll just go do your close-up, and instead of catching everybody else's stuff all at the same time, which would be the normal case, say we just move on to the next scene and just do the next master shot and Fred's close-up and move on to the next scene. So
crazy.
We would do that for about 7 or 8 weeks, and then Fred would leave. And then we'd go back and do all the scenes that he wasn't in, all the close-ups that matched the original masters that we skipped. Very unorthodox way of shooting. They'll never do that again, I'm sure.
It's crazy. Now, you were a big fan of character actors, and you ended up on My Three Sons working with two of the greats, William Frawley and then William Demarest.
Yes, you know, that was a thrill because, you know, I was obviously really well aware of William Frawley because William Frawley was Fred Mertz, and he, you know, he was very famous for Lucy. I love Lucy. So, it was a blast. You know, they were oddly similar in that they were both kind of cantankerous, older guys that had fought their way up into the business. They were very different because Frawley was quite an alcoholic. He loved to drink. And Demarest was a teetotaler. And, you know, Frawley was on first, but he eventually got a little too, his health was failing. So they eventually had to ride him out, and then Demarest was his replacement. You know, it was a little awkward, too, because they were competitors, for film roles for, you know, decades prior to that. So Frawley really wasn't happy about leaving, but they couldn't get him insured. And if you can't be insured by the insurance companies, then you're not going to get the job. So it was a tough call.
So it wasn't his death that caused him to leave. He was still healthy at the time that he left the show?
Yeah, he was in not very good health. They had to tell him, you know, Bill, you know, we're going to have to write you out. And he very graciously came back to, you know, to do a show or two. I think just the one or two that sort of explained his going back to Ireland. And then there was one show where they were both in it together, Frawley and Demarest. Mm. I think it was a pretty tense set that day. And, because one guy was coming in and it was his longtime rival, and that was tough. And then Frawley actually passed away not long after, probably maybe 4 or 5 months afterwards. And I think as story has it, he collapsed on Hollywood Boulevard in front of Musso Frank's, which was a great old Hollywood restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking with Barry Livingston, and he's just written a book about his experience as an actor, and including his years on My Three Sons. Well, what about Fred McMurray? What kind of a guy was he? A generous man?
No, you set me up on that one. No, he was known. You know, it's no big secret. I'm not, you know, slamming him. It was a pretty well known fact about McMurray that he loved hanging on to every penny and dime he could make. And that's, you know, whatever. That's just, he grew up poor, maybe. I don't know what the reasons for it were, but he was probably the wealthiest man in Hollywood, you know, but more so than Bob Hope. But again, he never got the publicity that the other guys got because he never gave anything away. All those other guys had charities and made enormous land grants. McMurray held on to everything. And he also got a, you know, in addition to being a major movie star for 25 years before he even came to My Three Sons, he did those films at Disney. He did The Absent-Minded Professor and Son of Flubber and Follow Me Boys, and they gave him tens of thousands of shares of stock in Disney.
That's good. Disney stock is good.
That was a gold mine, and so he, very wealthy man, but again, you know, he was a sweet guy, very nice, but you know, there was no invitations to his house for, you know, a family barbecue. And I think, you know, even every year Christmas, we would just get a postcard, you know.
Nothing. He never picked up a check.
He was famous for inviting people out to dinner, you know, could buy the restaurant and open a franchise of those if he wanted to, personally. But then he would start itemizing, you know, everyone ordered a grilled cheese. You know, you had to pay $2.50 and order, you know, cottage cheese on the side. That's another 50 cents. And quite a character that way.
So now, did you make enough money in those days? I mean, is there still any money left from My Three Sons? Did you get any residuals? Or?
No, it all went to Fred McMurray. You
know? Now it's out on DVD. Do you get any of that?
No. You know, it's kind of a shame. I mean, I'm over it now. You know, I know some child actors still have this huge resentment, and it's, what are you going to do? It's, you know, it's the unions caved on the negotiations that would have accounted for paying actors who, you know, whose work, you know, predated the cable. Cable really only came into existence in any kind of commercial way in the mid-80s, and so, you know, they actually came up with a contract to try to address how are we going to pay people whose work was prior to, I think, 75 was really the first contract that came up that addressed the issue of, here's a whole new delivery system of cable. You know, we're going to be, if we show your show, how are we going to pay them? They came up with some ridiculous formula, you know, makes no sense. So, and then My Three Sons really took off again in the mid-80s when Nickelodeon and TV Land started to promote the show and use it as kind of their primetime programs. Mm-hmm. But never got anything. Never got a set of nice cups, you know, coffee cups every year from TV Land, maybe a robe that says, you know, thanks, kid.
Well, you couldn't possibly want more than that.
I know, yeah. So, but, you know, the shock of it all has subsided over the years. And I've done quite well as an actor beyond that. And, you know, nobody else is getting any better. So I'm in the same boat with all the other guys.
Well, that's true. I mean, a lot of child actors from your era did not continue working when their shows went off the air. You mentioned Jay North, for instance, and your book, who played Dennis the Menace. But, you know, then there is the rest of you who have managed to make an interesting career for the rest of your lives, hopefully. And I want to ask you about another one of my heroes that you encountered in your post My Three Sons years, and that was John Cassavetes.
Yes, yeah, that was great. I was actually studying with Martin Landau, and Marty's career actually at that time was not anywhere near what it became. You know, his was prior to doing Tucker and prior to doing all the films that he did with Woody Allen and Tim Burton, where he won a couple Oscars. But this was probably the late 70s, and his career, you know, was in pretty much a free fall. And but you know, he was working a little bit here and there, and he was teaching acting. And I studied with him because I thought he was a great actor. I loved him in films like Nevada Smith and, you know, North by Northwest. But Cassavetes just wandered in one day. You know, we had a little warehouse we were working out of, and Cassavetes kind of popped his head in just by chance. And he was looking for a place to do some plays that he wanted to develop, direct. Two were written by another guy named Ted Allen. And John was going to direct all of them, but he wanted to do like kind of a repertory thing. And anyway, Landau and Cassavetes knew each other from years back in New York. And one thing led to another. Landau said, "You want to use my space here?" And it was like, "Yeah, sure, that'd be great." And so it wound up being this amazing experience of working with Cassavetes as he worked on all three plays, rewriting them. It was all kind of a big open rehearsal where, you know, if you had something you wanted to throw in, you know, you were more than welcome. John was very generous that way and, you know, encouraged people to improvise and if anything, it was a little out of control, but that's his style. And they were, you know, three great plays. One was Knives, which had never been done. I think he wanted to do it as a screenplay, but he did it as a play. And Peter Falk was in it, John Voight, Jenna Rollins, and then the other one was a thing called Love Streams, which actually he did make into a movie, but it was written by a guy named Ted Allen. And another was The Third Day Comes, another one by Ted Allen. So, yeah, it was a fantastic experience.
I bet. Well, not to take anything away from My Three Sons, but one of the great television series in the history of television is Mad Men. It's mm-hmm. won the Emmy for Best Show every year that it's been on. And you were part of that.
Well, you know, I've been very lucky to be in a lot of hit shows. I mean, I've West Wing, which won a slew. You know, did some work on that. Mad Men more recently. Big Love is another one. Everyone seems to, you know, of the current things, no matter what I've been in. I mean, it was in The Social Network, which won 3 or 4 Oscars.
Yeah, great
people
movie.
Love that. Great movie, but everyone still goes Mad Men. What was Mad Men like? Mad Men was, you know, was great. I was in the first season. Fortunately, I was part of the art department. That when the company got bought, they axed our art department, and I never returned. But it was it was at the very outset of the show. It was very exciting. You know, it's a terrific show. I'd love to come back, and you know, if it happens, it happens. But you have no control over those things sometimes.
Yeah, I remember you in Big Love. You were a lawyer.
Yeah, I was representing Harry Dean Stanton, who, in his big, polygamy trial or whatever. It was kind of one of the climactic episodes of the show. I did a few episodes, and he was, you know, he was the guy who was the patriarch of that, you know, the evil cult sect of whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was terrific. You know, great people, Bill Paxton, Harry Dean Stanton. It was a really great part for me. I really, you know, love playing lawyers, and I do that a lot. You know, I mean, I look, you know, people go, I wonder what he looks like now. Well, you know, I...
looks like a lawyer.
I look like a lawyer. I have no hair on the top of my head. It all slid down to over my ears, and glasses, and I look like I'm smart. I look way smarter than I really am.
So you no longer have the buck teeth, the horn-rimmed glasses, and the mo of the Three Stooges haircut.
No, I got the Three Stooges haircut took care of itself. The teeth I had straightened actually while I was working on My Three Sons.
Yeah.
Was wearing some kind of almost invisible braces that they had in those days. So, yeah, you know, that's my look today, and that's where I seem to excel, is playing doctors and lawyers and accountants and, you know, dads, that kind of stuff.
Well, we watched you grow up on TV, and that was a bizarre experience, but what was that like for you? Just, I mean, you know, most of us can look back at our lives and kind of picture where we were at some point in our lives, but you can actually look back and see exactly where you were.
Well, you know, I mean, when I sat down to write my book, The Importance of Being Ernie is the name of the book, I, you know, that's what I thought was my story. My real story is, of course, more than just My Three Sons, and my story is having an enormous amount of fame, seeing it disappear, which that happens, but when it happens when you're a young man, when you're, you know, a late teen, it's odd because everyone else's life is sort of just taking off, and mine kind of went off the cliff in my, probably more like my mid to late 20s, because after My Three Sons, I worked pretty consistently on Broadway and off-Broadway and a lot of TV movies, but, you know, just for no particular reason, one day the phone stopped ringing. And, but, you know, that's the challenge that I had to face. That's what I felt like I wanted to write about, that is what it took for me to, you know, get back on track, to get people to know that I'm still here, know that I'm a good actor, know that I have more to offer than just being the nerdy Ernie kid. And yeah, you know, I mean, it was years filled with some drug abuse, some, wouldn't call it clinical depression, but certainly a severe disillusionment with the way my life was going and the way that the industry had seemingly just turned its back on me. But I tend to have a pretty stubborn streak, and I just went, well, you know, I'm going to try to claw my way back into a career, and luckily I've never done anything but act. I mean, if it was even just working in dinner theater around the country in those days. So I was fortunate that I could still make a living plying my trade, but it took probably until the early 90s, mid-90s, when I, you know, really started identifying, you know, the kind of roles that I could do, and people accepting me in, you know, roles as lawyers as more of an adult. And in fact, I think the very first time, and I note this in the book, that I really was the guy, instead of the goofy kid, you know, the college guy gets, you know, never gets laid or whatever, you know, I was the doctor in Doogie Howser that was the specialist, the head Dr. Rickert. And, you know, I had a recurring role there, and I was the guy dispensing the critical information, you know, the need-to-know information. And you know, ironically, I remember working with Neil Patrick Harris and telling him, you know, he was at a critical crossroads in his career, and he was wondering, what'd you do? You know, he knew I was a child actor, and he was approaching probably the end of the show, and I said, I went to New York. I went Roddy McDowell, who was a child actor before me. Very famous adult actor, but he was a big child actor at MGM, and I asked him, and he said, I went to New York and, you know, worked on Broadway and learned my craft on stage, and you know, that was a great thing. And whether Neil went on to do the same thing, I don't know whether it's because that's he took my advice or other people around him, but ironically, that's the advice I gave him, and you know, certainly his career has taken off in a wonderful way.
Well, Barry Livingston, you say you've never done anything other than act, but perhaps you've forgotten you've also written a book. Let me tell everybody that the book is called The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. It's a great book. And Barry Livingston, thank you so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much. I love your show. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Barry Livingston. His book is called The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.